On today's Houston Matters Weekend, we look back at the many facets of Houston covered in 2016. We'll start with transportation, where Gail DeLauter made this realization.
We had a, you know, near meeting with a celebrity, and we sat in traffic. So the quintessential Houston experience here.
Then we'll take a look at our city and state's politics with Andrew Schneider.
Political scientists, I think, are going to be trying to analyze why this happened for quite some time.
And the reflection continues with business reporter Florian Martin and education reporter Laura Eisensee.
When you look at the history of school finance in Texas, when we've had reform and changes that have helped a lot of places, it's always been because of a court order.
Finally, we'll end with Catch Fever, a local band who helps us dance our troubles away. All that and more coming up on Houston Matters Weekend. Stay with us. This is Houston Matters Weekend. I'm Paige Phelps. It's time to talk gridlock and construction, toll roads, rail openings, all your favorite things, I'm sure. It's been a busy year for transportation in Houston, so today let's take time to recap this past year's biggest developments with News 88.7's transportation reporter, Gail DeLauter. Gail even manages to sneak in a reference to Simone Biles. Off we go.
I don't know that there's an easy way to get into this discussion other than to say there are lots of projects going on all the time and not nearly as quickly as any of us would like.
Well, they're in different stages. I mean, you've got to do the planning, you've got to do the building, you've got to do the checking up on it after you've built it. So there's a lot of moving parts here with all these big projects that we're looking at right now.
Well, let's start with Interstate 45.
Well, they've been doing the work around Bay Area Boulevard, and now they're going to take that project on 45 further south. The grand plan is to widen the freeway all the way to the Galveston Causeway. But there are three projects that should be starting up next year. And actually, it's one project, but they've divided it into three segments. They're going to start with a widening project between FM 518 and 517. That's going to be in the middle of the parameters for that work. And then they're going to go to the area near NASA Road 1, and then they're going to go south from there. Now, everybody asks, you know, what does that mean to me? You know, if I commute to Galveston or if I go down there frequently, TxDOT says they will have lane access open. If they do have to close anything, they'll give fair warning and it'll only be for a short time.
You and I visited the latest stretch of the Grand Parkway earlier this year. What have you taken away from what you've seen so far of development there?
We went to Simone Biles' gym.
That's right.
Yeah, we popped in there before she's a household name that she is now. So that was kind of interesting. We also sat a long time on 45.
Yes, and we did.
And yeah, that's kind of the takeaway. It's like we had a, you know, near meeting with a celebrity and we sat in traffic. So the quintessential Houston experience here.
We're talking about the latest segment of the Grand Parkway. This is between 290 and I-45.
They're known as segments F1, F2, and G. They've divided the whole project into segments, so those were the three that were completed. You can drive it now all the way from 290 on to 59 East Tex Freeway. So now what they do is they move on to H, I-1, and I-2, and this is going to take it all the way east, kind of making a big loop around all the way to I-10 by Mont Bellevue as you get into the Chambers County area.
Back in September, TxDOT gave the green light to extend State Highway 249, a toll road, into Grimes County. This, I understand, is a somewhat controversial project. Why?
Well, it's going to start in the area around Todd Mission, and everyone knows Todd Mission is a place where you have the Texas Ren Fest, and it is going to take it the road to the Navasota area. But there's a lot of controversy with private landowners. They feel like, you know, how's this project going to benefit us?
This reminds us of with right of way that there are some of these ranch land owners who probably have owned that land for decades, maybe their family for generations. And so they find themselves in a spot where suddenly TxDOT comes along and says, we need to build this toll road across your land. You need to sell to us.
Well, we talked to the representative of TxDOT's Bryan District. He says they're going to need about 600 acres of right-of-way for this project. He says it's not affecting any homes, businesses, schools, churches, anything like that. No one they would actually have to relocate, but it's still the issue of the tollway coming through your private property, which you may use for grazing or other agricultural purposes.
Grimes County residents, meanwhile, have raised concerns about another project, and this is the one that I think a lot of people are maybe even more fixated on, and that's the proposed high-speed rail line between Houston and Dallas. What are some of the concerns that folks in Grimes County have with that project?
Well, it's the same concern, having this train go through their private property, not being able to access one part of their ranch because of the sealed rail corridor, things like that. The Texas Central Railway says a project is going to literally mean billions of dollars in investment. They tout the fact it's being built with private money. They say no taxpayer money is going to be involved. But there is the issue of eminent domain. They say they do have authority to execute eminent domain to acquire property for this project because they are a public utility. The Federal Surface Transportation Board earlier this year said that basically that's an issue that has to be decided by the state, whether they can use eminent domain to acquire property. We also talked to Congressman Kevin Brady about it. He says he's not opposed to infrastructure projects, but he's one of those who's questioning whether rural landowners would get any real benefit.
Let's talk a bit about light rail. Houston riders might be surprised to learn Metro still has a segment of its light rail that hasn't opened yet. Where is it and when is it projected to open?
Well, you know, you're downtown and you see the trains that say Howard Hughes on them. We do have a rail stop here that's named after Howard Hughes over in the East End. That's where it ends right now, at Howard Hughes. You can't go any further to go to the Magnolia Transit Center, the whole controversy about getting the train over the Hughes Street Railroad track. They were going to build the underpass, couldn't do that because of soil issues. They decided to go over. They got the overpass built. It also has a car lane, so you can drive over it. But they're testing trains on it right now. You're probably going to see trains on there, but you can't get on it yet. So they're saying at this point they should have it ready to go in January. The Green Line has had some issues with ridership, but they say when the train is able to get all the way to the transit center, that should facilitate things for people in the East End because you can make true rail connections from there. You could take the train, say, to Magnolia and then get on a bus and go where you need to go from there. Or there's also a bike trail nearby.
You mentioned biking, and we have been, I guess, perennially watching as there have been efforts afoot by the city, by other municipalities around the region to try and improve biking and hiking in Greater Houston. Any sense of kind of where we stand on all of that?
Well, the bike plan is out there. It has not been approved yet. We're hoping to get some answers on that soon about where the project goes from here. But basically, it's a comprehensive bike plan for the city that addresses on-street cycling as well as bike paths that we have around the city. And there's been a lot of investment in that in recent years. And from what we hear, a lot of the conversation's been on how this is going to accommodate not necessarily your guy on the expensive 10-speed. Does anyone say that anymore, 10-speed bike?
I haven't heard in a while, but I'm sure somebody does.
It's the on-street riding. That's a big issue. You have a lot of people who ride bikes like to the Ship Channel or places like that because that's basically their best option.
Let's take all of these projects, put them all together. Let's say every one of them sails through on time without any complications, which I know is an unrealistic expectation. Does it have any noticeable impact on the continued and seemingly painful level of traffic that we have here in the region?
Well, I guess the best answer I can give you there is that's a good question. The phrase that we hear all the time from people in transportation and outside of transportation is you can't build your way out of congestion. They point to the Katy Freeway as a good example of that. You build lanes, someone's going to come in there and fill them up. But that is something that we've seen in Houston in the past few years, and it's been really fascinating to watch. A bigger demand for sidewalk improvements. A recent survey said that's one of the biggest issues in the city right now. Cycling has caught on in just a huge way, but there's not always infrastructure in every part of the city to accommodate that. You know, it remains to be seen if all these projects come to fruition, what it's going to look like. We may just need to build even more stuff after that.
This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. We're discussing transportation with News 88.7's Gail DeLauder. After our look back, it's time now for a look ahead at some of the transportation and infrastructure challenges and opportunities the Greater Houston region faces next year and in the years to come. Gail, you attended a panel discussion organized by the Transportation Advocacy Group, Tag Houston Pushes for Transportation Infrastructure Funding. The panel was made up of several area county judges, Fort Bend County Judge Bob Hebert, Montgomery Montgomery County Judge Craig Doyle, Waller County Judge Trey Duhon, Harris County Judge Ed Emmett, and Galveston County Judge Mark Henry, as well as Brazoria County Judge Matt Sebesta. What did they talk about?
Well, basically, the focus of the event was regional cooperation to solve transportation issues instead of looking at it as just a county-by-county or a city-by-city issue. Because we're in a situation right now where people commute from downtown Houston out to the Woodlands. So there's no real inbound and outbound anymore. When you get up in the morning, you've got folks traveling in all different directions. So everybody come together, look at it in a regional way to fight congestion rather than just a Montgomery County problem, Harris County problem, City of Houston problem.
These are men with very different agendas for their respective counties' transportation needs. Did those differences show?
Not really any differences. When you look at these different counties, they all have different things going on there. The average driver doesn't think, oh, I'm in Harris County now. Oh, I'm in Montgomery County now. All they know is they're on that freeway and they're not moving and they want somebody to do something about it.
We hear the term multimodal a lot. What does it mean and why is it important?
Well, that means moving goods or moving people in different kinds of ways. Usually here when they talk about multimodal, it has to do with putting cargo on rail. The Port of Houston is primarily a truck port. It's one of the largest ports in the world, but they're still moving things primarily by truck. And that causes problems not only with congestion, but also with air quality issues.
Galveston County Judge Mark Henry talked about this multimodal concern at the TAG event last week.
So if you look at I-10 and the number of lanes that are on I-10, you think about what would happen if that happens on 45 and 59 and 249 and every other road out there. You can only put so many lanes of traffic down. I think as we continue to grow, as the ports continue to become more active, rail has got to be a much more vital instrument for moving goods and services, at least to maybe some transfer stations out of this region to help avoid some of the truck congestion on our freeways.
Just to clarify, Galveston County Judge Mark Henry there is talking about commercial rail, not passenger rail. But on the passenger side of things, it seems like we have this conversation a lot about the need to shift from road to rail. But is this just about funding priorities or does it require a change in mindset to get Houstonians out of the habit of driving their own cars?
Well, it's all about money. It's always about money. When it comes to passenger rail, probably the only real initiative we're seeing right now locally is getting things organized with that 90A rail corridor that would come in from the west.
You have to convince people that whatever car culture they've grown up with, that it's time to change that perhaps.
Well, you've got to make it work for people. Say if you've got a rail line coming in from Missouri City, when you get to your destination, then how do you actually get to your workplace? Do you have a bus, rail, Uber? Do you bring your bike along with you? That's a big part of the conversation when it comes to putting in these new modes of transportation is the last mile issue. Okay, I'm here, but how do I get from here to my workplace?
By 2040, we'll have the population of Los Angeles on top of our population today. Brazoria County Judge Matt Sebesta said,
traffic is not going to get any better. It's not. We haven't been able to keep up for the last 20 years, much less try to get ahead of the curve. And I don't know if we'll get ahead of the curve. I don't know if there's enough money, enough right-of-way out there to make that happen.
Is Judge Sebesta there being pessimistic or just realistic?
He's being realistic. Actually, his comments were kind of in a positive vein because there's been millions of dollars, billions of dollars of new petrochemical development in Brazoria County. So there's concern as they try to grow these industries. How do they actually get those plastic pellets, as he phrased it? How do you get those out of Brazoria County? How do you actually put the transportation system in place to make it work for them?
How hard is it to add new rail lines?
It's money. It's always money. Where do you get the money from? Do you get it from the federal government? Do you get it from the state? Do you try to build a railroad on your own? So that's always a big overriding thing is money, right-of-way, purchasing property whenever you get into something like this.
Here's Fort Bend County Judge Bob Hebert.
We try and address planning on a regional basis. Counties are driven by a property tax. We can't access financial markets to fund the really immense size of some of these projects, such as rail, and some of the road improvements that we need. To say that Congress will grant funding for regional mobility development, that's a big if. But I think you get a lot closer to getting it done if you have a coherent, cohesive, regionally supported plan for mobility improvement. We desperately need that in this region.
Fort Bend County Judge Bob Hebert. How do counties fund these sorts of projects?
Well, there's different ways that projects can be funded, and what we're seeing more now is local entities putting up the money to finance projects because, you know, you can't always rely on the state to get what you want. You can't always rely on the federal government to get what you want. With a new legislative session on the horizon, there is concern amongst local jurisdictions, you know, what actually are we going to get out of this, and how will the money that we do get, how is it going to advance the region? And concern, of course, with a new incoming administration in Washington, you know, what's going to happen with that? We are seeing other initiatives. Jurisdictions are coming up with money for projects. Instead of having to wait for the federal government or the state government, they're just coming up with the money to do it on their own.
We've also seen a fair number of toll roads in the region. Harris County Judge Ed Emmett defended toll roads last week. Here is the judge talking also about one lost source of funds.
The Super Bowl is my favorite example. It's coming to Harris County. It's being played in a county venue. What revenue do we get out of it? Zero. The sales tax revenue that all those people coming in to see the Super Bowl, it all goes to the city or the state, but yet we're the ones providing the venue. The same's true about all those roads out there. Those roads that people drive on in unincorporated Harris County to come to and from the city of Houston, if we could get some of the sales tax revenue, we'd be much, much better off.
So he's looking for sales tax revenue. I mentioned he sort of defended the possibility or the value of toll roads, something that's not necessarily all that popular for anybody. Once you pull onto the toll road and you think about how much money you're spending, here's Brazoria County Judge Matt Sebesta.
The legislature meets every 2 years for 140 days. And I can tell you, I think most of us wish they met every 140 years for 2 days.
Do we have a sense of what we might see coming out of this next legislative session that would impact transportation infrastructure projects in the region?
Well, we've had the past two legislative sessions that have come up with constitutional amendments that were approved by Texas voters to kind of redirect where money goes. There was a real reluctance to initiate any new taxes to pay for transportation. So I think they're going to be looking at a lot of other things first.
Come on, let's go.
That was transportation reporter Gail DeLauder recounting our year of transportation. Coming up, if Houstonians weren't talking traffic, they were likely talking Trump. Reporter Andrew Schneider takes us down politics memory lane when Houston Matters Weekend continues.
About as big as a city can get.
This is Houston Matters Weekend. I'm Paige Phelps. Now Craig Cohen sits with Andrew Schneider, News 88.7's politics reporter, to rehash the Houston and Texas stories stemming from Donald Trump's win. And we're going to take a look at some big stories closer to home, such as Kim Ogg's defeating Devin Anderson in the race for Harris County District Attorney and Ed Gonzalez's being elected as the county's next sheriff.
The big story in politics in 2016, clearly that would be what? I don't know. Was there anything really all that interesting going on in 2016? Obviously, it's the rise of President-elect Trump.
I'm going to discuss our action plan to make America great again. We're going to discuss.
What do you take away from that whole experience that relates specifically to Houston and Texas, particularly in mind of the fact that I know you attended the GOP National Convention?
Yeah, I mean, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about this, and you know, it's difficult to get a read on how Houston reacts to this. But the one thing that you have to keep in mind is that as blue as Houston went by itself, I mean, it wasn't a complete walkover. Donald Trump got well over 500,000 votes here. So there are clearly a lot of people in Houston, not to mention Houston's surrounding counties, that are quite pleased with the result. Political scientists, I think, are going to be trying to analyze why this happened for quite some time.
What sets Houston apart from other cities around the country? But in many ways, Houston is politically divided as much as any other major city in the United States.
That's certainly a fair way of putting it. It's been barely a year since we had a mayor's race that went to a runoff, even though we are not a city that has partisan mayoral elections. It wound up being, in effect, exactly that, a partisan race between somebody who typically aligns himself with Republicans and one who was a Democratic state representative.
I'm Sylvester Turner, and I'm uniting Houston for a safer city, better roads, stronger schools, and economic opportunities for everyone.
All right, Bill King.
So we have a tweet that's gotten about 5,000 retweets, and it is that just because Houston put a man on the moon, our streets don't have to look like its surface.
And it wound up going to the Democrat. But that's precisely the point. I mean, we are a diverse city politically as much as anything else.
That said, it was interesting to watch on election night, as it was such an overwhelming victory for Republicans at the national level. And then you drill down to Harris County and everything went for Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's a mirror image of what we saw at the national level. We had a lot of incumbent Republicans who were thrown out. And to a certain extent, it's the same anti-incumbent, anti-establishment mindset that we saw that benefited Donald Trump wound up benefiting the Democrats here.
Who wins elections has an impact, of course, on how we govern, how we legislate. One of the things that you dug into this year was the question of what impact Donald Trump's election might have on the voter ID law here in Texas.
Right. And there are a couple of different ways to look at it. Obviously, one of the major issues that people considered when they went into the voting booth was who is going to be able to nominate the next Supreme Court justice, fill the seat of the late Justice Scalia, as well as, you know, possibly another two or even three others over the next 4 years. The voter ID case based on Texas's voter ID law has been moving up and down the courts over the past few years. Presumably, that's going to wind up in the Supreme Court's lap eventually. And when and if it does, whoever appoints the next few Supreme Court justices is going to have a big say over how that case goes. In the interim, though, President-elect Trump has already named his choice for Attorney General, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who is on record as basically favoring voter ID laws. So the way federal laws with respect to this are likely to be enforced is something that he will have a great deal of say in. It's very easy to imagine a Trump administration sort of standing back and let other people who are opposed to the voter ID law bear the water on this on their own.
Another implication of what we've seen in politics in the last year has to do with just how nasty, how angry campaigning was, particularly at the national level, but really maybe even across the board. I'm not sure we've seen as much mudslinging as we saw in the last year in previous elections. But one of the results of that has been this sense that it has emboldened some at political extremes to communicate hatred in ways that maybe we think are just too far afield. And something that you then dug into is kind of sort of the rise of hate groups.
King and two other white men are accused of kidnapping James Byrd Jr. and dragging him 3 miles to his death behind their pickup truck last June.
Today, you're listening to news coverage of John William King's trial for the murder of James Byrd Jr. That crime led to the passage of Texas's hate crimes law in 2001, as well as the federal hate crime statute in 2009.
I'm wondering if there's a connection there.
Well, I mean, my sense is that simply by the nature of President-elect Trump's speeches, a lot of people felt that the lid has been taken off, that if it's okay for him to say certain things against immigrants or against Muslims or against any particular minority group, then it's certainly okay for them to do so. Whether they escalate it is another question. The Southern Poverty Law Center was tracking a lot of, you know, not just hate crimes, but sort of instances of harassment and you know, related outbursts directed at minorities and other groups in the immediate aftermath of the election. And they tracked something like 900 such, almost 900 such instances across the country in the 10 days immediately following the election. And Texas had the third largest number of those after California and New York. by and large, the largest number of those were directed against immigrants. And certainly that was one of the groups that Donald Trump seemed to target the most frequently over the course of his campaign.
Not surprisingly, our discussion about politics and government in 2016 has been largely overshadowed by Donald Trump so far. But of course, there's been a fair amount of governance that has taken place this year. A lot of developments in certain issues here in Houston in particular. We saw that the mayor and city council signing off on developing an approach to handle the city's pension debt obligations. We saw the three pension boards get on board with that. It seems like Mayor Turner really kind of took office and sprinted out of the gate this year.
That's the sort of thing that gives me personally grounds for hope that, you know, that we can see some sort of effective governance. I mean, these are local examples, but you are able to pull every so often examples of cooperation at the national level. I mean, my personal favorite example, obviously one that affects a fairly select group, but there was a fair degree of bipartisan cooperation between our two senators, Senator John Cornyn and Senator Ted Cruz, and senators on the Democratic side of the aisle to try and make it easier for the families of Holocaust survivors to reclaim art that had been taken away from them by the Nazis. You know, it's a small step, but it's a start.
Then again, you could also say, boy, the threshold's pretty low if really all we can come together on is, well, we don't like what the Nazis did.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, given the level of rhetoric that we've seen over the past year, I'm willing to take what I can get.
As we look ahead to 2017, of course, governance will be very much on our mind and legislative action as the Texas State Legislature convenes. It's a six-month period, once every 2 years. What are you going to be keeping an eye on here in the coming months that's of particular interest, do you think?
Well, we've got several bills that Lieutenant Governor Patrick has already designated as being among his top priorities for the coming session. And a few of these have local sponsors. Senator Paul Bettencourt has sponsored or co-sponsored three of those in the top 25, one being efforts to overhaul the state's property tax regime from people that have seen their property tax bills growing rather quickly. Another one is a bill to try and make it easier to go after teachers or school administrators that have been involved in improper relationships with students. There's another one which directly bears on Houston because it came out of a controversy that we had when Anise Parker was mayor.
Dave Welch is executive director of the Texas Pastors Council.
No pastor should be faced with, certainly under the First Amendment, and certainly not in the state of Texas, to have the use of legal power to be scrutinizing the content of sermons.
It's a bill specifically aimed at protecting pastors from having to hand over the texts of their sermons, something that came about in the course of the fight over the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance.
Otherwise, what are you keeping tabs on politically, governmentally, between now and next December?
In point of fact, we have to remember that going back over the past 8 years, one of the things that our current governor, Greg Abbott, and when he was the attorney general, regularly said was, my job basically consists of going into the office and suing President Obama. Ken Paxton has frequently said the same thing. So the question is, well, what happens when you don't automatically have the federal government as a punching bag? What is the job of your attorney general then? I think that's going to be an interesting question to look at.
That was Andrew Schneider, News 88.7's politics reporter, speaking with Craig Cohen. Up next, we continue this reflection of 2016 with a look at education. Stay with us. This is Houston Matters Weekend. I'm your host, Paige Phelps. Today, we're recapping 2016's biggest news stories with our beat reporters. And now, boys and girls, it's time for Education with Laura Eisensee. And between a new commissioner of the Texas Education Agency, new superintendent for HISD, a Supreme Court case, and a scandal, Laura had a very full plate all year long.
Back in January, Mike Morath started his role as commissioner of the Texas Education Agency. Now, he's a known advocate for school choice and previously served on the Dallas School Board. What has he accomplished since taking office?
Well, I think it's been a difficult year for Mike Morath, and that's not necessarily, you know, putting it on him. I think the Texas Education Agency has had to deal with some pretty big issues this year. So just a few months into his term, we had this huge problem with testing, computer glitches with the state exams that really disrupted the testing for lots of districts across the state. And now more recently, we've had news broken about this benchmark that the state set for special education. Also, the schools that are struggling, that haven't been meeting state standards for multiple years. I think this first year for Mike Morath has been really marked by high-profile, important controversies and issues. And I think when we move into the legislative session, we might see more of this other priority that we're expecting from him with more school choice and vouchers, et cetera, et cetera.
You mentioned the benchmark for special education. Remind us what it was that we learned about what the state was calling for there.
The Houston Chronicle had an investigation that broke this news that basically back in 2004, about 10 years ago, the state quietly put in this rule, setting a benchmark at 8.5% for its special education enrollment. And so it created a lot of pressure on districts to only enroll about 8.5% of their students into special education. So since then, the enrollment in special education has dropped dramatically in Texas to the lowest in the entire country.
The Houston Independent School District saw some changes in administration this year. Terry Greer's last day as HISD superintendent was back in February. After 7 years of heading the largest school district in the state, what's his legacy?
I think his biggest legacy and that he was most known for was the Apollo 20 program. You know, that was his really big effort to help improve some of the struggling schools in Houston, to target these struggling schools and give students their kind of high dosage tutoring. Greer saw that as a great success. Critics said the results really didn't pan out over the long term. And in the face of budget issues, HISD has stopped funding that centrally.
Richard Carranza took over as HISD superintendent back in August. What are some things you think we should know about him?
Well, the first thing that everybody found out and loved was how he sings and plays mariachi music. I mean, the day he was voted in, he put on quite a performance. You know, he comes with a really interesting record from San Francisco, where he tried to reduce the number of suspensions for students. He increased the bilingual diplomas for high school students. So he kind of came with this call for equity in education. But I think HISD has some real challenges, especially on the money side, that, you know, they have to deal with. And so, you know, he may not be able to focus as much on equity as maybe he'd like to.
Zooming out to the statewide level, the Texas Supreme Court ruled the state's school funding system met the minimum standards and is constitutional. What were the immediate ramifications of this decision?
That was a huge decision, and it feels like it was so long ago, back in the spring. More than 600 school districts in the state, they asked the Texas Supreme Court to look at the system because they said it didn't fund enough for education, and also a lot of them said it didn't spread those resources fairly for all students. And a lot of people were really disappointed because there was no immediate action. You know, the Supreme Court said this system meets the basic constitutional standards, so the status quo stands. So the immediate impact means that school districts just kind of have to continue on the path that they've been on.
How about the long-term implications?
A law professor that I talked to, who's been involved in school finance for a really long time, I talked with him when that decision came out, and he said something that I thought was really interesting for the long term, which this could change sort of the tone and the course of school finance litigation in our state for the long haul. And, maybe some people might be happy about that and say, good, like, we don't need any more lawsuits. But when you look at the history of school finance in Texas, when we've had reform and, changes that have helped a lot of places, it's always been because of a court order. It's always been because of a court decision. And so the Texas Supreme Court kind of taking a step back and coming out with a different type of decision, I think for the long haul is going to put a lot of the responsibility on the state lawmakers as to how are we going to fund education? Where's the money going to come from? How are we going to pay for students who have extra needs?
I know you and I have talked about this, I don't know, about 100 times, but remind us for the 101st, what was Proposition 1? And
so Proposition 1 was basically asking voters in HISD, how do you want to pay this bill back to the state? Because HISD is now considered property wealthy. And under the state school finance system, they have to share some of their tax revenue with poor school districts by sending it back to the state. And so this proposition was asking voters, do you want to just send the state a check? And voters said no. So now we're going into these uncharted waters. One trustee called it the Twilight Zone. And the commissioner, Mike Marathi, has already sent HISD a letter saying that he is going to detach property, $18 billion worth, in fact, in order to collect the revenue from that and then distribute it for other education purposes. But in the meantime, we have the legislature meeting in January, and there might be a change. Lawmakers might make a change to the school finance system that gets HISD either out of recapture or maybe out of detachment or reduces the bill for recapture. So we'll have to see next year what actually happens.
The sun gonna shine in my back door someday. Just you wait and see.
That was our education reporter, Laura Eisensee, with Craig Cohen. Now let's switch gears to the year in business as Florian Martin, our business reporter, recaps 2016 with Maggie Martin.
This was a really rough year for oil and gas, the worst in the 2 years, 2.5 years that we've been in this oil slump. Back in February, the barrel of oil actually sold for $26, and we are doing much better now. The industry is doing much better now. We are doubled from that price. Now it's over $50 a barrel. And that's because we just last month there was an agreement by OPEC, by the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, that they agreed to cut oil production, and that immediately pushed the price up by several dollars per barrel, and it definitely helped. But we're still seeing layoffs, and we still have job losses every month.
As you mentioned, OPEC recently agreed to cut oil production for the first time in 8 years. What else does this mean or imply for Houston?
You know, it helped push up the price of oil, which is what Houston needs. We need higher price of oil. Ideally, over $60 a barrel. It's probably not going to happen anytime soon. Experts don't expect that next year. But we have to see what happens with that agreement by OPEC. Price of oil being pushed up is more kind of an anticipation of those cuts. We have to see if those cuts actually happen. They're supposed to go into effect January 1st. But, you never know if all the countries will actually implement them.
Are there projections of how the oil and gas industry will fare in the year ahead?
Yeah, so the Greater Houston Partnership just released its economic outlook for 2017. They anticipate 2017 to be much better for oil and gas, but still not back to its former strength. So it's still going to be a recovery year for the industry, is what they're saying. They predict that there will still be more than 3,500 jobs lost.
How's this trend in oil and gas impacting Houston's other industries, real estate, for instance?
Yeah, the commercial real estate market has been impacted significantly by the oil slump. There's a lot of open office space in Houston. Home sales, we've had pretty solid home sales this year. Other industries are more impacted. Construction, for example, construction is down in Houston this year, and it's expected to decline even more next year. And also manufacturing is impacted.
Florian, how well has Greater Houston's job market performed this year?
Not too well. Houston has had the slowest job growth among the largest metropolitan areas in the country. It's been growing by less than 1% year over year for the last 12 months. So there is job growth, but it's just really, really low. Throughout this entire oil slump, there hasn't been a month where no jobs were created, but it's always just been very slow. Our unemployment is still higher than the states and the countries compared to a lot of metropolitan areas. It's at the bottom. You know, Houston used to be kind of the driver of the Texas economy and ahead of the country. And we'll have to see if 2017 will bring Houston back or if we have to wait a little longer.
One, two, three, four. Gather round, friends. Why hurry? Let's all stay a little longer.
That was News 88.7's business and energy reporter Florian Martin. I think that's enough recapping 2016. We've only got a few hours left until the new year, so let's switch the mood a bit. You're going to want to put on a party hat.
Hello, my name is Mary Griffin. I am a recording artist, producer, writer, mother, strength keeper, very spiritual woman.
Mary Griffin. Breathe.
But I'd like to tell you how my story starts off, where I earned a scholarship to college, Grambling State University, where Grambling started me to opening up concerts. From there and getting that experience, I met the man that I married and went back to Grambling again. And while I was there, I fell off and wanted to be a mother a little bit more so than the music industry. But the marriage failed. I moved back to New Orleans. And at that point, a year later to the date that I moved there and rebuilt my life, Katrina hit. When Katrina hit, I packed up everything that I could in my car, drove to Houston because I had a show to do, did the show, came back, did my car at the airport, and that's when I realized you have nowhere to go. Stayed in that car for a couple of weeks, trying to figure out what my next move was going to be, and I got a call from a friend of mine that Christina Aguilera needed someone. I had enough money after doing that one show with Christina Aguilera to get a place, to get a mattress, start over. If you can get Houston to play your music, all of the other stations are going to follow. But now living here for 11 years, coming here through a hurricane, I was able to turn everything around. I am living in a better situation. I want to say thank you to this wonderful station, and I am very grateful. This is Mary Griffin. You can find me at marygriffin.com, and you're listening to Houston Matters.
This is Houston Matters Weekend. I'm Paige Phelps. So let's end this year with a dance party. Houston-based alternative rock duo Catch Fever visited Houston Public Media's Geary Performance Studio to perform two of their songs off their recently released You Have All You Need. We hear them perform the songs Eyes on the Stars and Lost Love.
Lost Love is about a struggling relationship and how frustration can build and the destruction that can happen when we forget to love.
Now
So when we first started writing Eyes on the Stars, we were getting ready to go record our second album. And really, when you start doing something you're passionate about, that you love, you hear a lot of naysayers, you hear a lot of negative things about what you're doing. And that song's really about just pushing through it. There's a lyric in there, dig deeper, go further. And it's about when you're at your wit's end, you feel like giving up, to just keep pushing through it because you don't know what's just on the other side of that hard time.
That was Taylor Huffman and Josh Wilson of Catch Fever performing at Houston Public Media. And that's it for today's Houston Matters Weekend, and that's just about it for 2016. Happy New Year! Don't forget that Houston Matters runs weekdays at noon and 7 p.m. right here on News 88.7. If you want more information about anything you've heard, head to HoustonMatters.org. And email us if you have ideas or suggestions. Our email is talk@HoustonMatters.org. I'm Paige Phelps. Join us next time for another edition of Houston Matters Weekend. In 2017, that is. Until then, take care.
Houston Public Media.